Now, we were speaking about St. Augustine, and I believe we were still on H, the city of God. Under that, we looked at 1, the political situation, at 2, the pagan reaction, at 3, Augustine's answer, and we were looking at 4, the effect of the book. And this book, as we noticed, was written in the interval of a very busy man's active life, who is concerned with all the practical details of the church in Hippo, a church which had grown tremendously since the time when he first became bishop of it, and which had extended out and established missions in the area around, many of which had become churches under presbyters who were under Augustine's direction, while some of them had been erected into independent bishoprics. But Augustine not only was interested in Hippo and the district round about, he was interested in the province of Numidia, which corresponds pretty much to present-day Algeria, and in that area he was constantly helping with advice and suggestions and important talks in connection with many parts of the province, and not only that, but the other province of Africa, the one further east, which is present Tunisia. In that one, he was very active often, too. And not only that, but he took an interest in the whole church, and he wrote letters all over the Roman Empire about many such. But in addition to that, he was engaged in violent controversies on which he wrote books and articles, and so this city of God did not directly deal with any one of these controversies. And so instead of going with it, as he did with the former Donatus controversy or the later Pelagian controversy, writing a long or a short book or an important article as a unit to be sent out in the face of a present crisis and widely distributed, he worked over the city of God for 10 or more years in his odd minutes. I wonder a man like that could find any odd minutes. But it contains much that is of tremendous value and is generally considered second only to his Confessions as his greatest production. But it has a very great weakness, as might be expected when so busy a man has to do something over such a long period of time. There's not the unity to it we might wish. Some things aren't thought through as clearly as we might wish. And worst of all, the essential idea of what he's talking about is not made absolutely clear. First, the real subject he's talking about is the fact that it is God's word that is vital and fundamental, that it is God's will that matters, that it is God's plan that is important, that only through Christ and his saving grace can anyone live a life that is worthwhile in this life or have any hope of eternity that is worthwhile. And this is the major thought of all of Augustine's writings, but the city of God deals specifically with this matter. The city of man has been overwhelmed by the barbarians, but the city of God goes on. And the important thing is that we belong to the city of God. But doing it in this rather spotty way, as he did, while it contains much of tremendous value, he never made really clear exactly what he meant by the city of God. And so while the book, like all of his other writings, had great value through the ages in their increasing the zeal of Christians and clarifying their understanding of many problems and being very helpful to the Christian life and progress of people ever since, up to and including the present day, there's no author who had more influence on the great leaders of the Reformation outside the Bible than St. Augustine. And there's no author who has had more influence in connection with the formation of various movements, various different movements at different times, which have set out to make a great Christian testimony than St. Augustine. Some people prefer, many people, they speak of Calvinism. Some prefer to call it Augustinian, because Calvin considered himself a true follower of Augustine. Some feel that Calvin improved on certain details of Augustine's teaching. But I think that many would think that Augustinianism is perhaps the larger term, from which Calvinism would differ very, very little, and that little only perhaps in developing certain aspects a little further than Augustine had developed them. But this book also had, we feel, rather unfortunate results that some people rather easily drew the conclusion from it. The city of man has perished. Now it is up to men to build the city of God in its place. And now it is up to those who are officers in the church to establish the true kingdom of God here on earth. You won't find such a statement anywhere in the Bible. It is a false conclusion from it, but it is it did undoubtedly give impetus to that development, as did his controversy against the Donovan, with its insistence on a unified organization. He did not believe in any unified organization with one man or a group of men at the head of it. He did not believe in that. He held that the churches should work together and should discuss the truth and see what it is and stand for it and root out from their numbers those who oppose the truth. But he never did anything to represent a military sort of an organization such as the Roman Church has developed. He never had connection with anything of that kind. But some of the result of his life very much contributed to that. And perhaps that also in Roman circles. And to this day, he is very, very highly honored in Roman circles. And when in the 17th century there was a great movement in France to follow Augustine's teachings, and the Jesuits opposed it and eventually rooted it out and utterly destroyed it, this movement, which was at one time a very great movement in France, called the Jansen movement, was started by Bishop Jansen, who had written a book called Augustinus, a book which quoted extensively from Augustine and presented his truth as related to human life. And the popes were in a very difficult position in condemning the book and the movement as utterly heretical, and yet not condemning anything that Augustine had actually said. They had to say they'd misunderstood him, they'd misinterpreted him, and so on. But I think one reason, of course, his Augustine's greatness is the primary reason, and yet one reason why he has been honored in all ranks of the Christian Church is that in that section, which was interested in developing a military type of organization with a totalitarian control, he unwittingly contributed to that. And his book, The City of God, did have that as an effect which came not from the book, but from the title and from certain conclusions drawn from the general thesis of the book by those who didn't take the time to read the book too carefully and really study it. Now we go on to a very interesting minor subject. We skip capital I because that would seem that we're going back to Roman numeral 1 again, so we make our next capital J. And capital J we call Augustine's relations with Jerome. Augustine and Jerome are the two greatest figures in the Christian church in the latter part of the 4th century and the beginning of the 5th century. And there are no two figures since the time of the apostles, that is in the early ancient church, no two figures more highly honored than these two. They were contemporaries. Jerome was quite a little older than Augustine. We know Augustine was born in 354, November 13, 354. We do not know the exact date on which Jerome was born, but we know that he is a fair amount older than Augustine. You remember that Jerome was the secretary to Pope Damasus, and when Damasus died in 385, Jerome had a violent quarrel with the whole of the Roman clergy, and in utter disgust at the clergy of Rome, he shook the dust of the city off his feet and left it never to come back, and went to Bethlehem. And there he established a monastery, and he devoted himself to study and writing the rest of his life, and has left an indelible imprint on every part of the Christian church by many of the things that he did. Well, he was somewhat older than Augustine. He was already quite famous when Augustine was a fairly new bishop of Hippo, still in his 30s. But Augustine wrote a letter to him, expressing admiration of his work. and inviting Jerome's attention to his own writing. It was a very courteous letter, but they didn't have mail service in those days. The government had their courier, but there was no mail service. The only way you could send a letter was to get somebody to take it. And so this letter did not reach Jerome. The man who promised Augustine that he would take it had a change of plans when he got to Italy. He had an offer of a good position in Italy and decided not to go on to Palestine. But Jerome was in Bethlehem, entered, so Jerome never got the letter. And then 2 years later, Augustine wrote again. And this time, the man who he understood was going to Palestine, and he asked to carry his letter, stopped in Italy, and he showed the letter to some friends. And in the letter, Augustine had, while he had praised Jerome and spoken very friendly fashion and trying to establish friendly relations with this great scholar, he did, in the course of the letter, venture to criticize Jerome's interpretation of Galatians 2:11-14, where it says that, where Paul says he withstood Peter to the face. And Jerome couldn't quite figure how could a great apostle like Paul and a great apostle like Peter have a disagreement. They couldn't, they must agree. Well, if you believe all apostles were inspired in everything they ever said or did, you have the same problem. But if you take what I consider a sane view of inspiration, that is that God inspires not the speaking of the apostles, not that he changed them and made them omniscient, but that he, in their writing of those books he intended to be part of the Bible, kept them free from error. And that otherwise, while they were very great men and good men and dependable on the whole, yet they were fallible like the rest of us and made mistakes, it is easy to see how even one of the very greatest of the apostles, Peter, after doing what was right in Antioch for a time when the men came from Jerusalem, would be carried away by his own dislike of having them think he was wrong, and so would simply quietly desist from eating with Gentiles. And Paul withstood him from his to the face, Paul tells us in Galatians. Well, Jerome said, these two men couldn't really disagree with each other, so we must conclude that Peter and Paul wanted to impress this important lesson on the people, and so they simply agreed beforehand that when the people arrived from Jerusalem, Peter would go over and just eat with the Jews, and then Paul would come over and would withstand him to his face, and that would impress it on people's minds. And actually, the two men didn't disagree. Now, of course, that is, I've known fine Christian interpreters who have held that everything the apostles did and said was inspired of God and was true. I don't think we have any scriptural warrant for that. We do have warrant that everything they wrote to be part of the scripture is free from error. And unless we take that attitude, we recognize, I believe, God's cause that this should be included to show us that even such a great man as Peter could make mistakes in his life and in his activities and in his thinking other than that which God caused him to express as part of the inspired writing intended for the direction of God's people through all future ages. But Augustine simply stated his disagreement on this point in the midst of a very nice letter, and in Rome, some of the clergy remembered some of the men who, like the deacon that I read you about, who loved to get good gifts from everybody and to eat the finest foods and so on. People like that who hated a man like Jerome, who felt that the Lord should be put ahead of all earthly pleasures, and who, in addition, was so devoted to study that earthly pleasures didn't mean much to him compared to the pleasure of study. As you know, in the case of certain men like Jerome, why these clergy in Italy got a big kick out of reading what Augustine said. This young bishop of Hippo, how he denies the statements of this great scholar Jerome, whom they didn't have much use for yet. For today, Rome considers Jerome one of their greatest saints. But they began making fun of this, and some people who went to friends of Jerome's were upset about it, and when they went to Palestine, they told him, "Oh, everybody in Rome is laughing at you because of what this Bishop of Hippo said and how he criticized him." Jerome didn't like it, but Augustine heard nothing about it. And so, after another year or so went by, Augustine, wondering why, after he'd written two letters, Jerome hadn't answered at all, not realizing Jerome hadn't gotten either letter, he sent him a third letter, and a very sweet little letter this third was, but when Jerome got the third one, he really exploded. And so in 402, Augustine got an answer from him, very sarcastic answer. Jerome says by that time, Augustine's fame was beginning to spread pretty well through the Roman Empire, and Jerome says, "Far be it from me to dare touch the works of thy holiness. I'm quite content to care for my own writings without criticizing those of others. For the rest, I, prudent, is well aware that opinions are free, and that the childish boastfulness only befitting you to seek renown by attacking illustrious men. Be content, therefore, to love one who loves thee, and do not thou, a youth, provoke an old man in the field of scriptural study." And Augustine, getting this, might have become very indignant, yes? No. No, the people who went to Palestine. The letter never reached him. He never saw the original letter. But people who came from Italy told him, they said, "They're laughing at you in Italy because of what this Bishop of Hippo said. He's getting quite a fame as a writer, this man Augustine, and he's making fun of you." And that's what Jerome heard. So then when he got a real nice letter from Augustine a year later, he told Augustine to leave him alone, not bother him. And he wrote him the words I just read to you along with other words. And we don't know whether he actually ever got the second letter, but he hadn't this time at least. And Augustine finds out what's happened. And so he wrote another letter, and he tried to make up with Jerome, but he criticized one of his translations in the book of Jonah, which Jerome didn't like very much. And Jerome was being criticized. People said the old Latin version was good enough for St. Paul. It certainly ought to be good enough for us. They didn't like his making a new translation, and any little thing they could find in it, they were criticizing. And, of course, the translation he made was thoroughly true to the Scripture. There was no denial of the deity of Christ, nothing like that. It was not to be compared with a version made by ungodly men. It was a version made by a great scholar attempting to put it into the language of his day, and so well done that today the Roman Church considers it as the inspired Bible, though most of the leaders opposed it. Many parts of it very strongly for a long time until it gradually won its way because of its great excellence. But when Augustine wrote him this nice letter, in which he did, however, make a slight criticism of his translation in one or two places, but he tried to make up to him, Jerome immediately replied, and he said he was now at no means convinced the sincerity of Augustine's explanation. He said, "My friends around here say there's some duplicity. You're trying to undermine me in some way. If you haven't written against me, how does it come that the Italians have got what you haven't written? Or why do you ask me to reply to what you now say you've never written?" He said, "Either send the letter to me signed with your own hand, or cease to worry an old man in the retirement of his cell. But if you're determined to exercise or parade your learning, seek out a useful opponent, one who is eloquent and noble." And he ended his letter with words, "Farewell, dearest friend, my son according to age, my parent in dignity. And let me beg of thee that in the future when thou writest to me, thou wilt take care that the letter reach me first." Well, if anybody ever had a right to be indignant, you say Augustine had a right to. He had a right to lash out and to say, "What's the matter with this irascible old fellow that can't receive a decent letter from a person and reply in a decent way?" But Augustine said, "Jerome is a great Christian. He's a great scholar. He's a man who's done much for the cause of Christ. And if he misunderstands me, that's not going to lead me to wrongly criticize him. And so Augustine wrote back a very friendly letter, and he says, I beg of you, if it's possible, we seek a subject to discuss whereby our hearts may be nourished without the bitterness of discord. And if I cannot say what may seem to me to need emendation in thy writings and thou in mine without the suspicion of ill feeling or the injury of friendship, let us refrain from such things and spare life and health. I know that I am far from that perfection of which it is written, if anyone offend not in word, he is a perfect man. Yet I think I may find it easy to ask forgiveness of thee if I have done thee hurt. And this thou shouldst make known to me, so that when I have heard thee, thou mayest have gained thy brother. Jerome wrote one more bitter letter, and then after that, Augustine's friendly manner and attitude toward him led Jerome to decide that he had misjudged Augustine. And from that time on, they occasionally wrote very friendly letters to one another. And when Augustine was in the midst of the Pelagian controversy, Jerome read Augustine's writings on it and said, Augustine is absolutely right on that. And even though the bishop of Jerusalem and most of the Christian leaders in the Palestine area strongly took the side of Pelagius, Jerome spoke out very strongly on Augustine's side. And in fact, at one time, the people there became so incensed at Jerome that a lot of monks and clerical leaders and vagabonds, they say, together made an attack on Jerome's monastery and ill-treated the inmates and set the place afire and destroyed a lot of the things in it. And Jerome had to flee for his life. He was an old man already, about 80 years of age. And Jerome, at the end, he and Augustine were standing strongly together for the truth. And you might say that it paid off Augustine's friendly, thoroughly Christian attitude toward a man who was completely misunderstanding him and with whom he could so easily have gotten into a bitter, an episode of bitter hatred and antagonism. So while it's not a tremendously important thing what the relations of these two men were, yet because they are two of the outstanding important Christians of the whole period, and because of the wonderful illustration it gives us of how a person showing true Christian grace with no thought beyond the immediate situation that he'd like to be friendly with this great Christian, eventually found that it was tremendously helpful to him 10 or 15 years later that he had Jerome's support. Now, he might have had it anyway, because Jerome might have been convinced he was right and given him that support, but he might not have. I feel that it's very interesting from these various reasons, and thus I give it this place on the outline, J, and when we go on to K, which will concern us far longer than J does. The Pelagian controversy, 411 to 431. And among our Christian people, Augustine is perhaps best known for this Pelagian controversy, because he is. It was something which affects our attitude toward the Bible and toward Christianity. He brought out the clear teachings of the Scripture in a way that has had a tremendous influence, particularly since the time of the Reformation. And so I will make number one under this, the outbreak of the controversy. Number one, the outbreak of the controversy. And under that, small a is Pelagius' background. Pelagius was a learned man. He wrote commentaries on sections of the Bible which were considered so good that even after Pelagius himself was condemned and disliked, these were circulated, and for many centuries some of them were thought to have been written by Jerome and passed under Jerome's name, though Jerome had been one of Pelagius' greatest opponents, as you know. He was a real scholar. He knew far more Greek than Augustine knew, for instance. In fact, his real name was Morgan. He was a man from Great Britain named Morgan. But he figured that the word Morgan means born of the sea, and so he translated into Greek. And he took the name Pelagius, which means born of the sea, just like the later Melanchthon, whose real name was Schwarzer, a German Man, the name means black earth, but he translated into Greek and made it melanchthon. Well, these are the two, one a great Christian, one a great heretic, who did that thing. There may probably were others that I have not come across. But Pelagius, or Morgan took the name Pelagius. I'm glad we don't happen to have a Morgan, I assume, by just at the moment. But I've known many fine people named Morgan. But this is one who was a very fine man in the eyes of the world. He was a fine man from the viewpoint of those who did not investigate his teachings. And that made the teachings all the more harmful. Pelagius was a man who was devoted to asceticism. He kept away from all worldly pleasures. And he urged people to live good moral lives. And he was very highly thought of. He left Britain, as it was called then. You can't call it England yet, because the Angles after whom it was named did not migrate there from Germany until a century or two after this time. But from Britain, that section of Britain, which we later called England, Pelagius went to Italy. And there in Italy, Pelagius had a great influence on many people, in leading them to live more moral lives and in leading them to live ascetic lives. And if he would hear of a young woman who had taken a vow of virginity, that she would never marry but devote herself to the Lord, he would write a letter to her congratulating her on it. Augustine also was asked to do that, because they both had this distorted idea of marriage, as we have noticed, which was a reflex. A reaction against the extreme laxity of the Roman world. But Pelagius, as he was urging people to live better lives and to be good, came across some people who were determined to live wicked lives, but who, when he would argue with them, would look for some excuse, and they thought they found an excuse in Augustine. And they said, God has elected me. I can't help myself. They said, I can't be converted, because they said God hasn't given me the grace. I can't live the way you do. God hasn't given me the grace. Augustine said, it's all of God's grace. I can do nothing good in myself. I would be lost in sin if it were not for the marvelous grace of God that saves me. Well, these people said God hasn't chosen to save us. So all we can do is go on in sin. Well, Pelagius, instead of bringing them the gospel picture of what the terrible fate is ahead for them if they continue in sin, and bringing them the wonderful gospel offers of salvation to all who will turn to the Lord, because no one can be saved except they turn to the Lord, and while no one can turn to the Lord except God gives them the grace, no human being can tell to whom God has given or will give the grace. We do not know. But Pelagius' answer was, these silly excuses, he said. Show your manhood. Exert the good human nature that you have. You're not naturally evil. You're naturally good. And here you're perverting and corrupting your natural character. And so he urged them to step out and be a man and live a good life. And many people said, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that Christian? Isn't that moral? Well, small d, Pelagius views. Pelagius came in conflict with people who had read Augustine's writings, and he came in contact with people who hadn't read them but who had heard a little about them, who were misinterpreting them and using them as an excuse. And he was teaching, all this talk about Adam's sin is all foolishness, he said. Adam would have died anyway if he hadn't eaten of the fruit, he said. Adam was mortal, he would die. Adam sinned, yes, it's terrible he sinned, but that doesn't affect you, it's your sin that affects you. Now there is an element, I think, of truth when it comes to our dealing with people in this. If somebody makes you the excuse, well, Adam sinned, why should I be punished for Adam's sin? You shouldn't enter into a theological argument with an unsaved person over the fact that we all died in Adam because of Adam's sin. Point out to him that regardless of Adam, he himself has sinned sufficiently to deserve God's wrath. and a person, regardless of Adam's sin. We all deserve God's wrath, and it's only through Christ's wonderful grace that we are saved. But how do we get into this position where we deserve God's wrath? We intentionally, personally, purposely have chosen evil rather than good, and we continue many times to do so after we are saved. But it is God's grace which gives us forgiveness through Christ. It is God's grace which brings us in situations where we hear the gospel. It's His grace which enables us to accept the Lord. It's His grace which saves us. And the presentation of the grace of God and of the crucifixion of Christ as bearing our sins is what God used as His instrument in bringing those who are saved to the knowledge of salvation. Well, Pelagius emphasized an entirely different faith, and faith like in Hebrews, he has not resisted unto blood, striving against sin. But he so emphasized this faith that he denied great and vital truth. But nobody seems to have realized it until Augustine came to see what Pelagius, how wrong Pelagius was. Well, this was C, Pelagius' view. Small c is Celestia. Celestia. Capital C-O-E-L-E-S-T-I-U-S. C-O-E-L-E-S-T-I-U-S. And while the heresy is called Pelagianism, the man who spread it more than anyone else was Celestius. Celestius was a Roman lawyer. A man highly trained in the law, who was a nominal Christian, and not particularly interested in Christian things until Pelagius came along. And when Pelagius presented his teaching of forsaking everything earthly and thinking of high morality and humanitarianism and living a good life and so on, it so attracted Celestius that Celestius became a close friend of his and became the one who did most to spread Pelagius' ideas. Just like Charles Darwin sat in his country home, sick most of the time, having to be in bed half of every day, and spending what time he could get writing his books, which he thought only scholars would read, but Thomas Henry Huxley went out and traveled up and down presenting Darwin's views. And it was Huxley that made Darwin's views accepted to a large extent, but the credit or blame, whatever it is, went to Darwin mostly, because it was Darwin who was, you might say, the main figure who thought of the ideas and Huxley presented them. Well, it isn't quite that much in this case, but somewhat similar. So that was C, Celestius, naturally. D is Pelagius, and Celestius visit Africa. And they made a visit to Africa when Augustine was tied up in the Donatist controversy in 411. They made a visit to Africa, and they called on Hippo and wanted to give their regards to the great bishop of Hippo, but Augustine was away, so he didn't meet them at that time. But they influenced a good many people there, and they left some of their writings, and when Augustine saw them, he immediately saw that they struck at the very heart of true Christianity. And so small e, Augustine's first treatises against Pelagianism, 412 to 415. The Donatist controversy was just at its climax in 411, and it was, you might say, the mopping up right after it was in these years. And he was getting busy planning his book, City of God, but he wrote a few treatises which were distributed, pointing out the terrible error of these views that Pelagius was printing, was distributing. And Celestius at this time asked a council in Africa to ordain him. He was not ordained. He was a layman. He asked for ordination. They examined him on his views, and under Augustine's influence, they denied him ordination and declared that his views were not worthy of acceptation in the Christian church. Now, number two is Pelagius in Palestine. Pelagius in Palestine. Small a, the spread of Pelagianism. It spread rapidly. It appeals to the natural heart of man. The image of God in man is not obliterated by the fall. As Paul said, that which I would not, that I do. And that which I would, that I do not. Then no matter how depraved a man may be, no matter how deep he thinks, he has some idea of how much better goodness is than badness, how much better high ideals are than wickedness. He has some idea. It may be jammed into the back of his mind, but there's something there that can be appealed to, something that will show itself on various occasions. And it can be appealed to with the gospel, but it also can be appealed to with a simple presentation of idealism or morality or high humanitarianism, or even with communism, the way it is presented by many of his advocates. It can seem like something that is so good and idealistic that it entraps many people who misunderstand its true nature. But Pelagius was a real thought, and he wrote well, and his books were distributed, and when he went to Palestine and Cilicia soon followed him there, they were well received and highly thought of there in Palestine. Small be the attitude of Jerome. Jerome immediately saw the evil of the people, and Jerome spoke out against it. But Jerome was a scholar whose works went out throughout the world, but he was not particularly highly regarded by those who were close to him, but who were not in his immediate circle. And in fact, there were many there who were jealous of him and were glad of a chance to come in conflict with him on something where they thought they had a chance to win out. And small c is a synod at Jerusalem. There was a synod at Jerusalem in June 415. And at this synod in Jerusalem, the bishop of Jerusalem was in presiding, and a man named Paul Aroceus from Spain had arrived in Palestine to study with Jerome. Aroceus, O-R-O-S-I-U-S. Aroceus was a Spaniard who had studied in Spain, had gone to Rome to study, and then had gone to Hippo to study with Augustine. And he was greatly devoted to Augustine's teaching, thought very highly of Augustine. And Augustine said, now in these particular areas of biblical exegesis that you're particularly interested in, I've given you all the help I can. But you could progress greatly by going to Bethlehem and studying with Jerome. Jerome would give you the next step you need in your training, he said. I urge you go to Bethlehem and study with Jerome. And so Paul Aroceus came to Bethlehem, and he went to the conference synod at Jerusalem, and there he saw Celestius and Pelagius received with great honor by the bishop of Jerusalem. And Aroceus got up and he said, these men are teaching what is unchristian. Augustine has pointed out their error. He said, Augustine has written against them. Augustine has shown what they've done. Augustine has demonstrated that they're not proper Christian leaders. And Bishop John got disgusted. He says, look at here. He says, I'm Augustine here. He said. And he didn't like to have him be quoting Augustine against him all the time. He said, I don't know what Augustine thinks of these men, but I think they're pretty fine men. And so he spoke very highly of them, and though they did, in view of Orosius' quotations and statements, they did refrain from ordaining Celestius as yet in June at this meeting. But the bishop at the meeting said, this is a difficult controversy, and it seems to have started in the West. Celestius and Pelagius came from the West. Augustine is attacking him there in the West. We don't have all the details on it here. Let's write a letter to the Bishop of Rome, to Innocent of Rome, and let's ask him to look into the matter and give us a judgment. He's there on the ground in that area. Let's ask his judgment about what the situation is. Well, D, small d, will be the synod of Lydda. Yes? Yes, yes. to write and ask him to look into the matter, which pleased innocent no end. But then small d is the synod of Lyddo, L-Y-D-D-O, another town in Palestine. This was in the following December, in December 415. And here at this synod, by this time, they had decided that they weren't going to let this African dictate to them as to what they should do. They had already seen enough of Pelagius and Celestius to have complete confidence in them. And so they ordained Celestius, and they declared that it was wrong to criticize these two godly men. And then small e, the attack on Jerome's monastery. That I've already mentioned. The group of the people got all stirred up and they attacked the monastery and burned some of the buildings in it, and Jerome had to flee for his life. But now we go on to number three, the controversy in the West. Now the controversy moves to the West again. And here's small a, the North African Synod of 416. In 416, there were two synods of all of North Africa held. That is, they got the two provinces, the bishops from both of them, to come together. Augustine never had an official position except as one of the bishops. The Bishop of Carthage was the prominent leader, but everybody knew that Augustine moved many times more than he did and was a far greater man. And they deferred to Augustine constantly, but he did not have a positional leadership. Yes? No. What kind? Capital letters, small letters, or Roman numerals? Oh, number three is the controversy in the West. You see, it began in the West, then it moved to the East, where it had its great development, and then it concluded in the, it goes further in the West, controversy in the West. And number three, and under that small a, is the North African Synod of 416. In the year 416, they held two important synods. And at these synods, Augustine presented the statement of what was being widely disseminated, the teachings of Pelagius, and he presented his answers to it, and the bishop overwhelmingly voted that Augustine's view was the truly Christian view, and that Pelagius and Celestius were not proper Christian leaders, should not be followed, and that their teachings about Adam's sin not affecting us directly, about Adam would have been mortal anyway, that any man could be saved apart from the grace of God, which God bestows where he will. These statements, they said, are unchristian and wrong and should not be tolerated in our churches. And they took a strong stand in these two synods, and then they sent a letter to Bishop Innocent, the Bishop of Rome. And they said to the Bishop of Rome, they said, we have investigated this matter thoroughly. We find that Pelagius is and Celestius are teaching what is unchristian. His teachings are widely distributed in Italy and in Sicily and in the East, and they have been distributed in North Africa. Here we are dead against them. And we wish you would join with us in condemning them. And number D, small d, is the letter of Bishop Innocent. And McCabe, who wrote a book called St. Augustine in His Age, who is very much for Pelagius, I would think, and who is, while he admires Augustine, he says some rather mean things about him, I would say, and he certainly doesn't believe in Augustine's viewpoint, yet he has a very interesting way of telling about this letter to Bishop Innocent, and how happy Innocent was about the letter, and how Innocent said that
They spoke about the great importance of Rome and the importance of the Bishop of Rome. And he says that Innocent was so happy about the things he said, he could hardly contain himself. He wasn't used to hearing such things like that, but he wrote back complimenting them on their good sense and recognizing the wisdom of the Bishop of Rome and the leadership that should properly be his, and saying they had done altogether right in condemning Pelagius and Celestius, and that he would join with them in the condemnation. Let's see the letter of Bishop Innocent. See is Augustine's famous sermon. Now Augustine, when this word came, he preached in Carthage a great sermon which had a great impression on the people of the day, in saying how now the matter is ended, and we should let's hope that the error will be laid aside and forgotten. And Roman Catholic books up until quite recently nearly all said that Augustine said in his speech, Rome has spoken, the cause is finished. But Roman Catholic books published in the last few years all say, Augustine did not say, Rome has spoken, the cause is finished. That is a misunderstanding of the letter. Somebody quoted it from memory and quoted it wrong. But they have quoted it through the centuries in that way. And they recognize that what he actually said was, the two synods have condemned Pelagius, and the Bishop of Rome agrees with them, the matter is finished, would that the error were equally finished. And this Roman Catholic book I have here says that, after all, he says, this is even stronger than the way that it was misquoted through the ages. Well, it may be stronger, but it does not, as the other does. Rome has spoken, the cause is finished, is not what Augustine said, but what he was frequently quoted as saying, and maybe some of the people who heard him got that impression either. But the very interesting thing is that before they got the letter, Pope Innocent died. And his successor, Pope Zosimus, said, oh, what lovely men are Pelagius and Celestius. Isn't it wicked that anybody would criticize them? And he wrote a letter to Africa, and he said, do not say anything against these men till I've made a further thorough investigation. He said, it makes my heart bleed to think that people would criticize such lovely men as these two. And even as Augustine said, the cause is finished. We've heard from the Bishop of Rome, and he agrees with us. A ship was on the way bearing the message from the new pope saying, go slow on this. They're too fine men to say anything against. I've got to look further into it. And we won't be able to look further at that till tomorrow.